with and consulting with. And we plan to do this in August and then to have this audio video tape.
This is 90.7 FM WGXE Hudson Catskill, the station that everyone loves.
The Chicago Trio Whirlpool aims to blur the lines between improvising and composing. We'll hear a track from their debut album on the next Deep Threes. Plus music from Suede Merritt, R. Millis, Amatron 7, Stavros Gasparatos, and the Bureau of Atomic Tourism. Deep Threes, music beyond boundaries for a digital world.
Tune in to Deep Threes after the noon news on Monday at WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Art Omai, a sculpture and architecture park and international residency center in Ghent, New York. Open daily from dusk until dawn. Art Omai presents the work of contemporary artists and architects across 120 acres of field and forest. Information at artomai.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Lenox Local in Lenox, Massachusetts. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Wake up! Wake up, wake up, wake up! Up you wake, up you wake, up you wake, up you wake! This is Mr. Senior Love Daddy, your voice of choice. The world's only 12-hour strong man on the air, here on We Love Radio.
Hi, I'm Andy Reid.
And I'm Mike Porter.
You're listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations on WGXE Acra 90.7 FM.
On each show, invited guests will be asked to discuss a number of items that they intend taking with them on their Catskill Cabin getaway. As we discuss their chosen items, it is hoped that you, the listener, will enjoy getting to know that person a little bit better.
Today we are doing something a little different. During this COVID pandemic, we thought it would be useful for the listeners to hear from healthcare professionals who are on the front lines doing the heroic work to save lives. As we discuss their experiences, it is hoped that we will all get to understand this difficult time a little bit better.
Today's guest is Jackie Lotz. Jackie was born and raised in Akron, New York, with her brother and sister. She went to Erie Community College, where she earned an associate's degree in respiratory therapy. While doing her clinicals at Rochester General Hospital, she was offered a job there and started 2 weeks after graduation. After 7 years at Rochester General, she went to work in Batavia, New York, at United Memorial Medical Center, and has been there the past 23 years. Jackie enjoys camping, fishing, crafting, and floral arranging with her 25-year-old daughter. Jackie, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Andy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, welcome to the show, Jackie. First of all, I say it's thank you for all the work you're doing during this harrowing time.
Yes, and thank you. It certainly has been a challenge these past few months, and we're just continuing on and hoping for the best.
You know, I wanted to interject quickly before we really get started. Our listeners should know that Jackie is, in fact, my aunt.
This is correct.
And some of my...
I'm sorry, Jackie. You had to put up with this heathen, this reprobate for the last 30-odd years.
Well, you know, my next point was going to be, if that is in fact true, she was one of the people that raised me. Some of my earliest memories are spending time with Jackie in Akron, New York at my grandparents' house.
Aunt Jackie.
My Aunt Jackie, that's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just said Jackie flippantly.
Jackie, what? I'm going to have to listen back. I was flippant?
It's okay.
I was going to say, I remember being 2 or 3 years old and Aunt Jackie carrying me into the high school to her locker. She was still in high school at that time, seeing other students, and 36 years. And Jackie, I want to say thank you for being a wonderful person, a wonderful aunt these past 36 years. It's amazing how fast the time goes.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Mike, being your aunt. And yes, I do remember that day very well, carrying you over to school and going to my locker and seeing a few teachers. And we have a lot of great memories over the years. I also remember when Michael was very little, I used to pick him up. And when it would rain outside, we would walk up and down and maybe trot a little bit with holding him in my arms. And just we'd play Singing in the Rain, and he would laugh. That. And
can I ask you a question?
Yes, please.
Have you ever changed Mike's diaper?
I think I certainly have, because I used to.
Bummer.
I used to spend summers.
That's what she said.
I used to spend summers in Massachusetts taking care of him. And I also have memories of him in the middle of the night asking for juice or something and taking care of him while my sister worked. But
cigarette.
A lot of great memories, a lot of great memories, and a lot of fun.
And talk about Singing in the Rain. There's a pretty decent storm that's been coming through Western New York today. And I think we're going to...
The woman's name is the name of the storm. Is it Kay or something?
Faye, I think, isn't it?
Oh,
Faye,
yeah,
is it?
I think it's Faye.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, I wanted to maybe get started with some of the things that you like to do, Jackie. Fishing.
Yep.
Where have you been fishing?
I think I'm just...
Water.
Yeah. I think I've just been a pretty small-time fisherman, if you will. I've not really been out in the ocean, but I learned to fish very young by my uncle and my dad and my brother. We'd go, and it just was something that I always really super enjoyed, just sitting by the bank and soaking some worms and hoping that you come up with something. And luckily, my daughter, she really loves to fish as well, and I think even the family does, you know, since camping and fishing and hiking has always been something with nature that we've really, really enjoyed. So I just never can get enough fishing. It just doesn't seem I ever get to it.
Now, is this cast in a hook and a weight and a float, or is this fly fishing?
I'd have to say it's with a bobber and a hook and a worm. I have never fly fished.
Me neither.
It looks
my brother does it now. My uncle and my cousin were very accomplished fly fishermen, but my brother does it, as I say, but I've never done it.
Yeah, me neither.
And what did he tell us? There's wet and dry. We learned in the last show.
Yeah, you know, wet and dry. Wet being if the fish a particular time of the day are down in the bottom, you need to let your line go to the bottom of the water.
Which would be wet fishing, because the bait itself, the fly, gets wet.
Yeah, and if it's dry, then it's the opposite. The fly's on top of the water.
Yeah. So, and Jackie, how did you end up becoming a respiratory therapist?
So, initially in high school, back all those years ago, they used to have career day. And they would come into the school, all the different professions, and you would travel around throughout the day and, you know, get a little excerpt of what that profession entailed. And I was initially excited to hopefully go to Syracuse to school. And then my mom was like, no, you're not going to go away from home. So luckily, Erie Community College is right close by, had a great program. And so I decided to get into respiratory therapy. I didn't want to become a nurse since my sister was already a nurse. And I just was looking to do for something different, and it was really appealing, and I have enjoyed this career for 30 plus years.
And tell us about this job. What does a respiratory therapist do?
So a respiratory therapist is really a, if you will, more focused, obviously, on the respiratory system. And it's a job that really is cradle to grave, if you will. A respiratory therapist is needed at every aspect of life. I attend C-sections for high-risk deliveries, And hopefully those babies come out just as screaming and fine. But unfortunately, there are times that resuscitative measures are required. As well as we see a large pediatric population when you look at children who maybe have asthma, as well as sometimes, you know, there's children who are born with CF and cystic fibrosis, and they're in need of respiratory therapists. And then as you progress on through life, you know, we see the middle-aged people, and of course, you know, if there's strokes and heart attacks, respiratory therapy is right there because we're the breathing people. We're the ones that keep you breathing, and unfortunately, codes or cardiac arrest sometimes evolve into intubations and putting people on ventilators. And then unfortunately, towards the end of life, there are times that there are situations where we have to remove people from life-saving devices. And so it really is truly a profession that goes all across the ages.
Yeah, you kind of summed that up well there with, you know, saying that it's completely across the spectrum.
Yes.
It truly is, isn't it?
It is. And if you think about it as well, you can also branch out into home care, as well as I myself do pulmonary function testing and have been involved in pulmonary clinic for people with COPD and other diseases like that.
You know, as an aside, I advise the weightlifting club, the fitness club at school, and I like to maintain a CPR certification. And, you know, it never really occurred to me for whatever reason, like, holy smokes, Jackie is probably a CPR guru master, I suppose. I'm assuming you've had to perform CPR.
Absolutely. Yep. CPR, basic BLS, is something that is a minimum, as well as ACLS, which is advanced life support. And then respiratory therapists are also required, at least for my particular job, NRP, which is neonatal resuscitation. And there are so many other certifications that respiratory therapists can do. There's PALS for PEDS, as well as, you know, adult critical care certifications, again, pulmonary function certifications. So respiratory therapy sometimes, I think, is a forgotten profession. It's so vitally important, and I'm glad to bring some things to light for people to see just exactly what respiratory therapists do and how important part of a team we are. We bring a lot to the table to take care of patients.
Well, that kind of takes us on to one of the main reasons that we have you on today, Jackie. Obviously, in the last 3, 4, or 5 months, things have taken a turn for the worst in this country, or around the world, rather. Obviously, with COVID-19, can you explain to us, how has that impacted you on a personal level? How has that impacted your job? And how has it impacted you on an emotional level?
I think let's go with the emotional level. It certainly has been quite a ride since the beginning, you know, when we were starting to see Wuhan and everything that was happening there. And then as it started to happen in Seattle and everybody was watching and we were starting to prepare, and just really not knowing enough about this, and with more and more information coming in, it was really scary not knowing how we were going to take care of all of these people and what we were going to be in for. So I think scared was really my first initial feeling. Mm-hmm. I certainly do remember when SARS was in Toronto back many years ago. And we were watching that very closely, and that was very unnerving and scary. But then knowing how big this was getting, I think scared and fearful was my first feeling. For the hospital, we really started preparing early on, and luckily we were getting a lot of good direction from the state and starting to see what was going down in New York City. It's really interesting to see how, in a short period of time, we were required to increase our beds by 50%, and as well as, you know, the direction of the hospital was that they were going to stop all elective surgery so that we could accommodate a surge, and a surge that we didn't know how big it was really going to be. There was just no knowing. And just the constant preparing, and of course the big word was ventilator, and a respiratory therapist is somebody that runs your ventilator. And in the little hospital that I work, we have 4 ventilators. So you can see right how we would feel very overwhelmed.
You get 10 people that come in the hospital with breathing problems. There's 4 ventilators.
Correct, yes.
That's it.
And so luckily we are with Rochester Regional Health, and so our sister hospitals, we were all in very good communication and working well together to figure out how we would best manage the patients of this area.
You know, I wanted to add that, Jackie, as a respiratory therapist, of all lines of healthcare workers, you are truly the center lineman in this whole deal of a pandemic, because in terms of human communicable disease, you have horrific things like Ebola.
Yes.
Ebola is a terrible, it's like 90% fatal. It can only be transmitted, though, through like touching a person, through bodily fluids and things. Same thing with like HIV. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, despite these diseases being so horrible, they at least can be contained. The other thing about those is generally people are shedding when they're symptomatic. And I think in the case of a respiratory illness, the danger is that it's transmissible simply through breathing. It's transmissible simply by touching your face and then touching something and someone else touches that something. It's way more communicable.
Correct.
And in that way it can be, and also asymptomatic transmission.
Yes.
That's the other problem. And so
could you speak a little bit more about that, Jackie? Sorry to cut you off, Mike.
It's okay.
So you must have a lot of anxiety and fears around the transmission of COVID-19.
Sure. Absolutely.
You must have an acute awareness of specifically why that is. Could you maybe, in an effort to maybe teach somebody who's listening,
yep,
why it's very important to wear a mask?
Absolutely. So Mike is right that, you know, this is very transmissible through coughing, sneezing, sometimes breathing, just normally. If you're asymptomatic and shedding the virus, you can be shedding that virus to surfaces and anyone else. So wearing a face covering and an appropriately worn one, which means over the nose and mouth, to protect.
Not pulling it down to talk to somebody and then putting it back up?
No, or not wearing it under your nose or under your chin, because then you're really not protecting yourself or anyone else. And since this is so communicable, that's why wearing the mask is so darn important, as well as that hand washing. And if you haven't washed your hands, really try hard not to touch your face. I see a lot of people out in the community wearing gloves, and those gloves are great as long as after you take the gloves off, you sanitize your hands before you touch your face to take the mask off. And so there's all those little dynamics to it that, yes, covering your nose and mouth is vitally important to helping stop the spread of this virus.
And New York, thankfully, has followed these guidelines, New York State, pretty well since March. And, you know, talk about flattening the curve. The state, at least so far, has been really textbook with that. And Jackie, can you talk at all about what does that mean to flatten the curve?
So I would totally agree that in the initial stages when Governor Cuomo was, you know, having his daily briefings, I know he still is doing that, we were watching that every day to see this flattening of the curve. And I think the governor did a phenomenal job with his recommendations. And flattening the curve means if we didn't put the halt on people moving around and closing things down and mass gatherings and, you know, mandating wearing a mask. Remember I told you about that surge of people? We could never have been prepared enough for a surge of people if we didn't do that. We needed to keep things closed. People stay home. Wear your face masks in public if you cannot socially distance, which is so important. Flattening the curve is absolutely necessary for us to have gotten through this.
Because at your hospital, there are 4 respirators.
That's right.
And this is in an area where there are thousands of people.
Correct.
And so the nature of this disease, transmissible through as a respiratory illness, mm-hmm. people can be asymptomatic in spreading it. You can easily, through this exponential growth, have healthcare facilities totally overwhelmed.
Absolutely.
And is this a good time to, like, so hypothetically, what happens? Okay, 4 respirators at the hospital, 15 people come in.
So,
well, sorry, Jackie,
yes.
as a layman,
mm-hmm.
I think I heard or read somewhere that there's been an ability to devise a situation where you can hook like 10 people up to one ventilator. Is that wrong? Is that a fabrication?
No. When the time was happening and in the midst of everything, we were getting communication from our top hospital, Rochester General, Rochester Regional Health, as to how to split a ventilator. Now, in theory, for 30-some years, it's one ventilator for one person. But in a situation like that, we were having to devise plans so that we were ready for this surge, if you will, and how we would try to split a ventilator to serve two people. And it was very scary because I was thinking to myself, how are we going to save these people to split a ventilator to take care of two people? And you just can't put people on based on who they are or who walks in the door. It is based on their size and their lung comparisons, their disease states. And so there was a lot that was going to go into that, and very scary. It should be one ventilator for one person.
So basically, Jackie, everything that you've learned in the last 30 years, put it to one side for a moment. We're going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So how did that feel?
Very scary. My manager and I sat there when we got the schematics of how we would have to divide our ventilators.
How you would have to?
Yes.
Not some mechanic that comes in, some ventilator dude that graduated from ventilator engineering school.
No.
This is respiratory therapist Jackie, who is...
That's taking two separate patient circuits with, I hate to say it, some parts that would be purchased from a Home Depot for flow changes so that you could separate flow out so that they were still separate, but coming from one single ventilator. And
even at that, that allows you to serve eight people as opposed to four people.
Yes, but is eight people even enough? You know, we did have to get creative. There are MASH casualty ventilators out there that are very primitive, or I don't know if rudimentary might even be the right word, but certainly not the fancy bells and whistles of a ventilator that you would want for yourself or a family member, just purely to try to keep people alive and survive this.
Now, I don't know if this is the right time or the right place to actually discuss this, but I'll ask you anyway, Jackie, what kind of things have you seen?
I have certainly seen some very heartbreaking situations through this COVID-19. There was an elderly woman that came in very short of breath. We were very concerned. We don't know at that particular point as she rolls through the doors if she is COVID positive. So we are all taking the precautions of N95s, another mask, shields, two sets of gloves, a gown, and just running into a negative pressure room to try to help this woman. And you've got nurses on one side trying to get IVs. You've got anesthesia standing at the door ready to intubate. Myself and another respiratory therapist trying to hook up heated high flow on this particular woman to help her breathing. Her oxygen was so low. And just holding her hand as she's really just crying out, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. And that's all she knows what to say because she can't breathe and she's so scared. And
panicked, yeah.
Very panicked. And your heart is just truly breaking as you're looking into her eyes and she doesn't know you and all she can see is your eyes. And it's, I have you, I've got you, trust me, I have you, I got you.
I wanted to talk about that a little bit, Jackie. You know, the experience of somebody when they come into the hospital, their families are not at the bedside.
No, they are not. They are unallowed to come in during the COVID.
So these folks are truly alone. They're alone with people who, as you said, can only see your eyes because of the nature of the PPE.
Correct.
that you're wearing. And I wanted to, first of all, I want to just go back and talk about, you know, what happens when 15 people arrive and there's four ventilators, and then maybe get back into like the PPE and let's maybe talk about, you know, you're like an ET, those government agents,
kind of.
you know, that sort of thing. So really quick, what happens? You have four ventilators. You've done the Home Depot deal. You've got them. They can serve maybe four people a piece, right? So you can serve 16 people with this. It's going to be rough, from what I can gather. This is not optimal.
Oh, absolutely not optimal. Because we did stop elective surgeries, we had phase one, phase two, phase three, which our senior leadership at our hospital did a great job at commandeering our boardroom, and they were there 24/7 on a hotline, and we were going to turn the ASU or ambulatory surgery unit into a COVID unit where we were going to house all of those ventilators if we were going to see that big of a surge. In essence, if we had our four ventilators and we had those all in use, that's where luckily we were connected to Rochester Regional Health in Rochester, New York, with Unity Hospital and RGH to try. And if they had ventilators, we could either ship our patients to them or they could ship the ventilator to us. And then again, I told you about those little mass casualty ventilators. We could keep people going with that in the short term. And then our last ditch effort to try to keep people ventilated, because you can ventilate somebody with an ambu bag, but then you're taking one person to do the breathing for that patient. You don't have enough staff. There's never enough staff. There's never enough equipment in a situation like that. We do have non-invasive ventilators that, in my time of using them, we have never used them invasively to ventilate a person who has a tube.
What does that mean?
Invasively and non-invasively?
Yeah.
So these particular machines will ventilate you in a non-invasive manner, which means that we put a mask over the nose and mouth, and it's a pressure mask. It's very tight, and it helps to force air in and out of their lungs. So in this particular COVID situation, since we knew ventilators were at such high demand and we couldn't get any more, we can turn those ventilators into invasive. Once we intubate a patient and put a breathing tube down into their lungs, we can change those settings and try to ventilate them that way. Again, not ideal, but in a crisis situation, whatever it took to save as many lives as we could.
Right. Now, because this is a new virus, have you been in situations, Jackie, where you've seen things, you're like, I don't have a clue, I've never seen that before, I don't know what to do here? I know that may be putting you on the spot, but...
I think with this coronavirus, I mean, coronaviruses have been around for forever, I would assume. I mean, SARS was a coronavirus. And so what was so hard is that not any one person or two people come in the same. Mm-hmm. It affects everybody so differently, just as you've been talking. Some people will have it and be positive and totally asymptomatic and fine. You know, then there's people that come in and they maybe have mild symptoms. And then there's young people, old people that come in and you're like, oh my goodness, what are we going to do here? Their oxygen is so crisis low that you just have to jump into action and hope that you're making the right decisions for them. And initially, ventilation, that big word again, was the way that we all thought we were going to save these people. From, you know, they were going to probably develop ARDS, which is adult respiratory distress syndrome. And then as we've continued to walk the road, we found out that once we potentially put people on ventilators, it was very hard to get them off ventilators. And that's what was so hard for us to learn, is that we were going to struggle to get them off, and that maybe other modes, such as heated high flow, could maybe be a better option for them.
Have you been involved in a situation in your hospital where you've had to say, right, so we need to save one person here and let the other one go?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, and unfortunately, that was other discussions and talks and meetings that we were in for ventilator allocation. And so if the surge had gotten so big and we had run out of ventilators, there was ways of medical doctors and ethics groups and way higher than my pay grade could decide based on people's symptoms, their... multi-organ system failure would be graded, if you will, or put at a level. And then that's how they would decide and color code them, that if you were a yellow and we had a person that came in green and needed the ventilator, unfortunately, the yellow person's name would be drawn out of a hat if there was more than one as a lottery situation, and that person's ventilator would be taken away.
Wow.
And that, I mean, you think about that and it's like how, again, no family. We did have a person that came off the ventilator, and the nurse sat with that patient for an hour and a half and just held their hand until they passed. And it just really gets you right to the core.
I'm sure.
You know, Jackie, I wanted to just interrupt for a second. We're talking about the PPE, and, you know, as a respiratory therapist, before COVID, last year at this time, you get up in the morning and you get into the hospital, and like what's simply your routine? Do you need to wear a mask all the time, a shield all the time, full garb all the time when you're with patients? Describe to us what it was like before COVID and then what it's like after COVID with these precautions.
So really before, it was just kind of standard precautions. You would just go about your day. If it was a contact person, you know, you would have gowns and gloves. If it was somebody who was in airborne precautions, you know, you would have an N95 for that. But your N95 was, you go in the room, you wear it once, you come out, it goes in the garbage. Because they're really designed to be worn more than once. And then COVID came, and you have these potential people ready to, you know, run the door, and everybody taking care of them. And it's...
Now, what do you mean run the door?
If we got a surge, then we don't have enough masks to do what I just said, where you go in and wear it and throw it in the garbage. They were telling us we had to wear it and keep it in a bag for up to 5 uses or more until we could get more PPE. So the PPE was really an issue. I mean, we were really trying to conserve as best we could, but every patient you went into, because they were suspected or known COVID, you have to have an N95, a mask over top of that to keep it clean so that you could wear it again, a huge shield over your head so that, again, you were protecting your eyes, and then a gown and gloves. And so that was almost every patient if they were suspected or known. And again, in the height of all this, most everybody was suspected, correct?
Yeah.
And so in a crisis situation or a code situation, there were definitely times that, you know, you'd be in a room for 3+ hours with all of this garb on trying to help a person.
You know, there might be some listeners that think to themselves right now, you know, so the disease is, what, 96% of people survive it. It's generally the elderly or people with comorbidities. You know, these folks who are healthcare professionals, doctors, nurses, respiratory therapists, they're generally young, they're generally healthy. Isn't this just a little overblown? I mean, do you really have to? So if you get COVID, chances are you're going to be fine. What's the big deal? What would you say to that?
Absolutely not. I mean, I'm over 50 years old, and I'm very afraid of getting it. I can tell you of a patient who was a few years older than me, definitely COVID positive. Unfortunately, oxygenation falling rapidly to the point where anesthesia, we were ready to intubate this woman. Again, total stranger to all of us. All she can see is our eyes. We're ready to come in the room and put her on a ventilator and get her in a better standing. And you say to yourself in your mind, is this the day I'm going to get it? You know, is something going to happen? Is something going to go wrong where I'm going to contract the virus now? But I need to help this person and save their life. And
are there some younger people that get the virus?
Absolutely.
Are there some healthy people that get the virus?
Mm-hmm.
Do we understand why it is that some young, some healthy people get the virus and die?
And I think that's what's so puzzling to us, is that it doesn't appear to have any rhyme or reason. It's just so different in every person. It's just purely a roll of the dice as to how, if you get the virus, you're going to react to it and how well you're going to get through it. Let's hope it's very mild and easy and you can get through with it. And maybe you have to stay in bed for a couple of weeks. But unfortunately for this woman, we intubated her and she coded. But luckily we got her back. We saved her. And how scary, how scary. And I just think, you know, God bless her.
Did she make it?
She did make it. Thank God. But
it is God.
You know, we put the tube down, and after that, we, you know, lost her blood pressure. Her heart rate started dropping. Her saturations or her oxygenation started falling. And it was very scary because, you know, at that point, you're committed, you're all in. And the thing with this virus is that this aerosol generating, when you talk about, you know, the coughing, the sneezing, aerosolizing those virus particles, intubation requires, you know, putting a blade in somebody's mouth to put a tube down into their lungs, putting a mask on their face and trying to, you know, put breath into their lungs creates this aerosol. So you're spewing virus particles all over the room and anybody who's in there. So that's where, as much as, your heart is breaking for this person and your will to want to save them, there is those things that pop into your mind, is this the day I'm going to get it?
Sure. And you know, we were talking about Governor Cuomo and New York State and the measures that we've taken since March. You know, a lot of New Yorkers say, I'm not wearing a mask. I think it's overblown. Or maybe they say, you know, we're not on this planet forever. And if it's my time, it's my time. What are your thoughts on that? On someone who says, I'm going into the store, I'm not wearing a mask.
I think it's very selfish, first and foremost, because you're not only playing with your own life, which is your choice, but you're potentially harming anyone else around you if you're positive and asymptomatic and spreading or shedding that virus to other people. And how sad is that, that we do not care enough about one another and humanity to do the right thing, which is to wear a mask. It takes a few seconds to put it on. How long are you going to be in the store? You know, 30 minutes at most. I think all of us can wear the mask for that long until we get back in our car and take it off and sanitize our hands. So I think it's up to everybody to do the right thing. And to do the right thing is to wear a mask in public if you cannot socially distance.
Now, Jackie, without getting political, because this show is, we stay away from politics, because we're an entertainment show and we don't want anybody getting angry or feeling, you know, anxious about something we may say or may not say. But what do you, how do you feel at the moment about how our country is handling this?
I think our country and our leaders in Washington could be doing a better job of this. We know that mask wearing is important. We've been watching what the CDC has been putting out and their concerns and their thoughts about things. I don't understand why our leadership in the White House doesn't understand that the mask and the face coverings is really what helps curb the spread of this. And I just wish that they were a little bit more serious about it. And I think they're missing the boat.
You know, as an aside, I've heard it compared, you know, mask wearing to no shirt, no shoes, no service. I don't know if I've ever heard in my 36 years on Earth somebody say, I'm going into this restaurant without a shirt on. I'm not wearing my shoes because it's my right. It's just something that we do. And why? Well, it has to do with people's health. When you're walking barefoot in a place, you can be transmitting disease. If you're walking in without a shirt, you're shedding skin and hair, and that's gross. If you go and, you know, not to make light, but someone says, you know, you go into a restaurant without underwear on or pants or something, you know, you're getting your butt all over a seat. That's gross. It's unhealthy. It's why we have to wear clothing. And so our modern climate with COVID, it's along those lines. It's just a
absolutely.
It's just a health thing.
It is, and it's the right thing to do, because you're if you don't want to protect yourself, you should have enough sense to protect the person potentially next to you, or anybody else that's walking down an aisle somewhere. It's just the right thing to do, and we can totally, you know, stop the spread by wearing a face mask.
And maybe someone at home.
Absolutely.
You know, what was it? I heard George Stephanopoulos maybe got it and was asymptomatic, maybe cleared the virus.
I believe that to be true. I believe George, actually, his wife was positive, and then I believe George was positive and had no symptoms whatsoever.
But some people, you could have a spouse that ends up hospitalized.
Correct.
And a spouse that was not.
And we did see that, and especially in some of the older populations in the nursing homes. I remember going into a woman's room and, you know, setting her up with some oxygen and trying to, you know, make her feel better. She was positive. And just how heartbroken she was that she had lost her husband just a couple of days before at the nursing home. They shared a room. He was COVID positive and passed away. And now she was with us in the hospital, and we were trying to save her life as well. And just how devastating for her that she had nobody but us, you know. And here she is enclosed in a room. The door is shut. The fans are on. And just doing our best for her.
I think it's important to also recognize that for anybody listening who has chosen not to wear a mask in public or has decided that it's their right not to wear a mask, I think, first of all, one of the ironic things is that person will probably get into their car and put their seatbelt on.
Yes.
Because it's the law.
Yeah.
They don't feel that their rights have been impinged on when they put their seatbelt on. But another thing, if that person actually does contract COVID, where do they go?
They go home.
They go to the hospital.
Oh, yeah.
And the people that are enlisted to help them are people like you, Jackie.
Correct, yes.
And you really, you obviously you have a choice. Your two choices are you decide not to do it or you stay there and you help somebody. So that person is then putting you at risk.
Correct.
While asking you for help.
Mm-hmm.
Jackie, Andy, sorry to interrupt. Were you going to say something?
No. I just wanted to make that point, the ironies and the contradiction and to re-emphasize the what Jackie said, that it's selfish.
Yeah,
it is. And unfortunately, you start to feel inside when we were in the height of everything is, you know, how can some people be so arrogant not to wear it? You know, because will you be at our doorstep in less than a week? Struggling to breathe and need the nurses and the doctors and the respiratory therapists to save your life. And we're going to be there to do that. But it could be so much easier for yourself to just put a mask on and try to prevent the spread of the virus and take care of yourself.
Absolutely.
I was going to ask, so I was wondering, so what's the hypothetical situation? Somebody is at home and maybe they've been careful and they've taken the precautions, or maybe a little cavalier, maybe they've gone to some social gatherings and whatever, but they're at home and they notice over the course of hours or a couple of days, geez, I've been getting this sore throat. I have this tightness in my chest, and suddenly they have a cough. They're having trouble breathing and it gets to be a little bit more extreme and they're really struggling and they think, you know, I think I need to go to the hospital. Could you take us through, so what happens? They've arrived at the parking lot in the hospital. What then?
So initially when COVID started, you may have heard of something called a tent city. And a lot of hospitals were creating a tent city, if you will, out in their back parking lots. And that's what we had because we couldn't have people just coming into our waiting room and potentially, if they had COVID, infect anybody else that would be there. They would come through tent city. They would be assessed in every way that possible. And if they were deemed as a probable COVID positive person with the shortness of breath, the fever, the cough, the tightness, they were immediately brought right to the emergency room doors. Even though the doors are closed, everybody on the other side is garbed, ready to go, and they are taken immediately to an N95 room and the door is shut. And then that patient is then taken care of and assessed as to what their needs are.
I see. I should have written it down as something else I was going to say.
Now, moving forward slightly,
yeah.
Jackie, first of all, how do you envisage this going forward? How do you envisage society? You know, given the current state of the America's ability to handle this, because it doesn't look very good.
Not at the moment. Now, when you see what's going on in Texas and Florida and California and Arizona, they're really a hotspot right now, like New York City was.
So how do you see this playing out, in your opinion?
It's very worrisome. You know, talks at the hospital is, are we going to see a second surge in the fall? Mm-hmm. Are we not going to see a second surge? You know, these places, I really hope, do get it under control. And they do, unfortunately, they opened maybe a little early, in my opinion. That's just my opinion. You can throw it in the pail if you don't like it. And now here we are. They have terrible spikes. They're over capacity. They're running out of ICU beds. I'm very fearful of what the fall will bring us. The only thing that I can hope is that, again, the mask wearing and I know they're working on a vaccine, as well as I know that remdesivir has been used in the treatment of this. So I don't think it's going away anytime soon. I would not be surprised if we're still dealing with COVID next year in some way. But let's hope that each day that we learn a little bit more and we're more prepared, so that I fully believe that if I am hanging around for another 30 years on this planet, I would not be surprised if something like this crops up again.
Yeah, and we should be ready for it.
Yes, we should. Better prepared than we were this time.
Now, another question I have for you, Jackie. The president is suggesting that, well, this is actually a question for both of you. The president is actually suggesting that he is expecting schools to go back into session at the end of the summer. What's your fears, if any, for that, Jackie? And how do you feel about that, Mike? Jackie first, though.
I guess I'm nervous. I'm nervous for the kids. You know, I think, you know, a lot of people are like, well, the kids, you know, they don't seem to get so sick. But, you know, we did see all of those children in New York City with those strange symptoms and were very sick. It's going to be really interesting that if we just go full force and let them all back in, where this takes us. I think the schools, unfortunately, are going to have to get a little creative. I understand these kids have to get back to school. It's important for them, the education, the socialization. It's difficult for parents. What do they do for childcare, you know, and teaching the kids? I just hope that if they do make the formal decision that they're going to let the kids back to school in the fall, that they're really good at limiting the amount of children in any one particular area and try to keep them 6 feet apart, whether they're alternating from online learning at home a few days and then in session in school. We're just going to have to see how this plays out. I'm a little worried.
Yeah. You know, schools, any social gathering place, a school, a church, it is a germ factory, particularly with children. And the difficulty, especially with humans, it's hard to get humans to be under control.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost impossible with children. You know, I see it in the hallways, the group of first graders walking down the hall and their nervous systems aren't yet fully developed. And so there are these kind of rubber band bouncy things and the line of children stops, but the kids in the back, because they're craning neck, bam, bump into each other and they're holding each other's hands and wiping each other's faces and
so, sharing each other's food.
Yeah. So there are germ factories. So that's a problem that makes it difficult.
Yes, it does.
You know, I read an article in USAtoday.com just yesterday. Three educators battled COVID-19 after teaching in the same room. One died. And this was in Arizona just recently. So there is this potential. And it's not just for children and teachers. It's for all the people they go home to. It's mm-hmm. to their parents and to their grandparents.
Correct.
But that's not to say that we have to everyone crawl into a cave for the next year. We can be smart about it. We can be prepared about it. There are ways to socially distance. There are ways to disinfect. We can wear masks. We can do online learning. We can have staggered schedules. There's a whole host of options that we can live as normal a life as possible, that we can maintain the economy as well as possible. It doesn't have to be one extreme or the other. And I'm confident that the United States of America is a great place to live. I think one of the best, maybe the best country ever in the history of the planet. And we're even better when we're united.
I would agree.
When we use our minds, when we work together toward a goal, toward an objective, and tackle it together, remembering that we're all Americans. And if we can do that in the fall, if we can do that at schools, if we can do that in our society, we're going to come out even better on the other side of this. I hope it can be that way.
I would agree with you, Mike.
Well, I would say Scotland's the greatest country in the world ever, but that's just me being biased.
Yeah.
But, you know, I agree. We need to come together exclusively, and we need to put the politics aside. We can't continue throwing dices.
Correct.
With people's lives in order to get reelected or to get newly elected. We can't do that. This is nothing to do with politics. Let's save people's lives.
Correct.
And it's, I mean, the data is relatively clear. I was looking at it recently. You can look it up, do a Google search. You can, any reputable source. If you look at New York State in March, right, in early March, there were hundreds of cases a day, 300, 400, 500. Mid-March, the state shut down. social distancing, have to wear a mask, schools, churches, no social gatherings with more than like 8 people together. That was hard. It was a sacrifice. But because of those measures, some people would say that wasn't it. Well, then I don't, maybe it was magic. Maybe it was God. I don't know if it wasn't that. We flattened the curve back down to, we went from a peak of 10,000 cases a day in April back down to 500 now. And we've plateaued there and hung there, which is phenomenal. The rate that we've suppressed the virus.
Correct.
Now, you know, for what it is, the data, simply, other states have not done that. They just simply didn't choose that path. They didn't buy into that philosophy of following what the science said, following what the math, the statistics, the research said. And now they have levels, 10,000 new cases a day, and are only now just starting to take measures.
And so what's going to happen in the next few weeks?
And this is, and I hope people don't think that I'm like gloating or you know, something like that. It's a horrible tragedy, but it's like, this is not some political thing. It's just science. It's a virus, and it kills people. And we've found a way, there's a way you can defeat it. And it doesn't mean destroying your economy. It doesn't mean closing down society forever. There are ways through it. And I hope that as Americans, we can come to realize that and come together and do it together and come up better on the other side. Sorry, I keep saying that, but...
Do it better together and have more of a feeling of taking care of humanity.
Yes.
And your brother. And that's what's important.
And sister.
You know, we only have about 10 minutes left. And I wanted to thank you again, Jackie, for being on the show with us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Yes.
We're not quite done, but I thought we could take a little breather and talk about some fun things.
Pardon the pun there, Mike.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
You're saying, let's take a breather.
Sometimes I say these things that are like puns and things, and I don't even realize it. People laugh at me.
But it was one of your famous transitions.
But so, you know, Jackie, camping.
Yes.
Because of COVID, people are camping.
Yes.
RV sales are through the roof. People are traveling. It's this ideal situation. You don't want to go to a hotel. Hotels can be germ factories, right? Potentially. And so, potentially. So people are like, hey, you know, I get an RV. I can go to some beautiful, faraway place. I'm in my car the whole time. I get my own food. I have my own bathroom, my own bedroom. I stay away from other people. It's a vacation away from COVID and away from everything. And so I looked into RVs a little bit. The first RVs were actually built in 1910. Now, I saw a picture online. I don't know if it was true, but it was like a Model T looking car and a black and white picture with like a Cape style house built on top of it. I don't know if that was real, but apparently that was a thing. Have you guys seen the movie RV with Robin Williams?
I believe I have.
No,
I just watched it with my wife Nicole and her parents the other night, and it was really good. It was really funny. They drive a 35-foot Georgetown 359, huge, you know, bus RV, and then there's also a classic 1948 flexible clipper in the movie, which is more of a retro thing. The Gornickies drive that. So now I wanted to ask you guys. Here's a little bit of trivia. Take a guess. Marky Mobile's Element Palazzo Superior, I think I pronounced that right, the most expensive RV in the world, what does it sell for? What do you say there, Andy?
I'm going to be thinking you're going to have like golden toilets.
They have marble. They have leather. Yeah, it's out of control.
Encrusted with diamonds and all that stuff. I'm going to say $3.2 million.
3.2 says Andy. Jackie says...
I think I'm going to go a dollar over. Do I win it?
You don't. Neither. You're both over. It's $3 million, but really, really close.
Oh, that was close.
Really close. Do you need a place to host more people in this Palazzo Superior? No problem, as the back of it folds out into a sky lounge, complete with a fireplace with just the push of a button.
Now that's glamping.
Yeah.
That is just having a $3 million drivable home. You still get it. Somebody can still drive into the back of you a grocery store, you know.
Dink. So yeah, RVs and camping. It's the new rage.
Well, we've had a lot of good memories with that.
Yeah. So, well, the last couple things I wanted to talk about, Jackie, your faith and how this experience has helped you to grow in your faith. And lastly, if any patients in particular have stood out in your mind, if there's a little you'd like to say about that. So, and you mentioned that earlier. Tell us about that, how this has affected your faith.
I definitely am a believer in Christ Jesus, and I thank you and thank him for the blessings that he has given me in my life. And through this start of this COVID-19 nightmare, definitely it has just strengthened my faith in Jesus, and that just everything is possible with him, and he's in control. And when I'm with these patients and I'm holding their hands, you know, it's offering a prayer, whether they know that I'm there and I'm holding their hand, that God's just going to continue to be with them and to be with me and to be with all of us through this. And definitely has strengthened that I know where I'm going. And I do remember two patients. Again, she was a little bit older than myself. And I just remember just staring into her eyes and knowing the fear that was in my heart, concerned that I might contract the virus with what we were about to do and how sick this poor woman was, and she was so alone. But thanks to the Lord, she's alive and well, and we got her through. And there is another woman that was an amazing story. She was 94 years old, and unfortunately, she's like, I'm 94. If it takes me, it takes me. And we got that woman through, and she actually was on a local news channel at how well we got her through this. So she's another person that's one of those great stories that we were able to help. So
fantastic.
Definitely.
Well, if you're, what's her name? Oh, you can't tell me her name, sorry. You know, if she happens to listen to this or hears it, God bless you, Ollian. Well done for getting through it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's fantastic. I know we're hitting the end here, but I just want to say, Jackie, and to everybody who's involved in helping people, thank you very much from the bottom of my heart, and for keeping all of us safe in our beds at night, and for sharing your wealth of knowledge and your experiences. And let's hope that it gives people a reassurance. And for anybody who's listening who's chosen in the past not to wear any masks, that today, going forward, they change their mind because of this.
I would hope so, too. And I thank you both for having me here today. I thank all of my comrade in arms, so to speak, the fight that we're fighting, the enemy that we can't see. We do the best every day at the hospital to help each and every person that comes through the door. And we just want you all to do your part with us, to wear those masks, keep yourself safe, keep your family safe, keep your neighbor safe. And through this and through the strength and will of God with all of us, we will continue to get through this.
Yes.
What if we were to finish with a song?
I don't have to sing, do I?
Can we do it?
Absolutely.
Oh, I just love Nat King Cole. You could play anything and it would just please me.
L is for the way you look at me. O is for the only one I see. V is very, very extraordinary. E is even more than anyone that you adore can love. Is all that I can give to you. Love is more than just a game for two. Two in love can make it. Take my heart and please don't break it. Love was made for me and you. Me, is for the only one I see. V is very, very extraordinary. E is even more than anyone that you adore can love. Is all that I can give to you. Love is more than just a game for two.